Welcome aboard. I'm Mendel. This is Water Bodies, and today we're bringing you a conversation that challenges some popular assumptions about False Creek. Namely, that it's so polluted, it's devoid of life. We're here to say, in fact, no, False Creek is alive. Today's anchor, Matt Brown, is sitting down with Chris Harley, a professor of zoology at UBC's Institute for Oceans and Fisheries, as well as Colleen Kellogg, microbial oceanographer with the Hackay Institute. They discuss everything from how we can think about the different levels of biodiversity, the features of False Creek, both physical and social, that affect it, the impacts of climate change, how False Creek might become a living laboratory, and of course, the 2022 BioBlitz, a community science survey that revealed over 500 different forms of life in False Creek. So, today we're diving into how science connects us with the living world. Let's take the plunge.
So the lovely part about getting into this conversation right away is we're sitting on the ocean, and I wanted to ask you about what water body matters most to you, but I think because the water body we're sitting on, I want to tell a story about why it matters to me and where I got the idea that made me really excited to be part of this episode. When I started working on False Creek, there were two of the greatest advocates for this watershed, Stephen and Jonathan Petko, who run Skookum Brothers Yacht Services. Nobody spends more time underwater in False Creek than these two guys. They pulled derelict boats out. We had this program called Sea Bins. I don't know if you've heard of them or not, but they're like trash skimmers. It was a great idea. It just didn't work. But what was really interesting about it was they were a part of the coalition that we built to try and work on these. And as we were emptying them, volunteer work, it was great community science work, we kept learning that we were picking up more organic debris than we were actual plastics and contaminants and even like species. So that was alarming. But they had a great point when they said, you know what, this is the moment kind of where we have to kill our darlings. Like, it's just not working, but we tried. And they told a story of how they came up with this thought was they were under the water and they kept seeing plastic float by. And they would go, oh, we need to do something about this. But then they flipped it and realized the thing was there was so much organic life around them that this plastic stood out. And that was when they said to me, the reality is that False Creek is actually quite alive. And it stuck with me and I went, wow, that's such a nice thing about urban watersheds. And it went, that's why False Creek now matters to me, is because of what they said to me. So why does False Creek matter to you two?
I live here. I think you really hit the nail on the head with describing how it's when those two guys were in the water and seeing things happen, that's what inspired, you know, them to wish for a positive change. I don't literally live on False Creek. I live a little ways down the shore in Kitsilano, but the idea of being able to come down to the shore and enjoy it is really important to me. And I want my kids to be able to enjoy that. I am happy that lots of other people like doing that. And there is a lot of nature right on the shore and in False Creek to bring us joy.
Yeah, I guess my answer is pretty similar. I was thinking about how I just feel very lucky to be able to get to the ocean so quickly, being an oceanographer. Sometimes, you know, if I feel stressed or if I just need to take a break, it's awesome to be able to come to False Creek or to the shoreline, Spanish Banks, and just kind of be one with the ocean. And so I feel like False Creek matters a lot to me just because it allows me and others to really connect with nature, even though we're living in a giant city.
The interesting part about the urban watershed aspect of that is that the two of you, with your credentials, I'm sure have spent countless hours in some of the most remote, beautiful places. But yet, majority of us live in urban areas where we need to be connected closer to the water, as you're saying, Colleen, the whole blue mine theory. What makes urban watersheds so unique to the two of you to work on compared to, you know, some of the other spaces you've been in?
I guess one thing that has been pretty neat in getting to work with like Falls Creek friends and work on Falls Creek is actually like a lot of my work in general is out in the Salish Sea, further disconnected from people or on the central coast of BC. But working in an urban watershed allows you to connect with the community and with people that really identify with the area where you are. And so I find it very gratifying to kind of get to be an oceanographer, do what I do, but then also kind of give back and engage with the community and try and get people excited about what's right at their doorstep. And so I think that is a neat thing about getting to work in a urban watershed.
I'm so glad you went first. That is a way better answer. My perspective was completely selfish, which is I am disorganized and it's easier to get down to the shore here than to plan a big trip up to the Central Coast. And I love my family. And so when my oldest kid, Zoe, was born, I spent a lot less time going out to the wild outer coast and a lot more time walking to the local shorelines and learned an incredible amount about nature by doing that. And then there's those fringe benefits that you mentioned, Colleen, of it's a great way to inspire the other people that are here and give back to the communities that we live in.
Yeah, that's such the point of community is so nice to know, like you're just, the engagement level is just so much higher in that sense. And, but Chris, I always think about one thing I learned is when I started working in conservation is access is imperative. And, you know, a colleague said, you know, clean water is accessible water. And I thought, yeah, that's such a good point in urban watersheds or this area where it seems like access is there, but there are actually a lot of barriers that come along with that. So I would ask you then, like, what are some of the key barriers to not just access to False Creek, but to the overall, caution to say health, because it's such a complicated word, but like betterment of False Creek, longevity, whatever it be.
I think there are some public spaces which encourage that sort of, you know, like participation in nature, and whether that is taking the sea bus or walking along the seawall where you can actually look and, oh, it's, you know, the tide's low and there's a starfish down there. That's cool. But the whole shoreline isn't that way. There's very few places where you would say, hey, kids, go run off down there and pick up that starfish because it's sort of an intimidating, very industrialized shoreline for most of it. So finding ways that people can just sort of explore their curiosity, I think, is going to be really important. And whether that's in some of the, you know, uplands where streams are being, you know, uncovered, unpaved, or down at the beach at low tide, or, you know, out on the water in a kayak. I think there's a lot of ways to do it, but, you know, not everybody's got access to a kayak. So how do we engage more people in these options?
I think even though it is close, not a lot of us take the time to go kind of explore the shoreline. Yeah, and certainly not getting down to the actual water. And I think not everybody has the opportunity to make it here. So when we've thought about like moving or something like that, we're often like, oh, if we get too far away from the water, then it'll be hard to actually take the time to get there. And even people that live close by don't get to like take the time. So I think just the motivation is a barrier. I also think like having people kind of look beneath the water is a barrier. So we kind of think of it, I think probably because of all the boats moving around, as just a highway, but there's a barrier in like knowing that there's things in the water and not just on the water. We see a lot of the birds going around or the seals, you know, but never really thinking about maybe everything else beneath the water. So that's a barrier too.
Would you consider pollution as a barrier or the perception of pollution a barrier?
Oh, yeah. I did think of that at the start. Yeah. It's like people's maybe misconception that like Falls Creek is not alive is a barrier because you need to change people's point of view or help them see that there is more to Falls Creek than just the boats on it.
Yeah. I grew up in Baltimore, and Baltimore's inner harbor is a very polluted place. And as a kid, even as a kid who spent a lot of time in nature, I never once, while, you know, in downtown Baltimore, thought, wow, I really wish I could go down there and play on that bit of shoreline. So I think we do have a little bit of an advantage in Vancouver because of the, you know, the way the water is deeper and it flushes a little bit more than some other places, that there still is quite a lot of life. But there are also a lot of boats, and sometimes you see a sheen of oil, especially in the marinas, and there's plastic floating by, as you've already alluded to. And so it's not pristine, but I think we can, you know, continue to be aware of the pollution and then work to find ways to minimize that and minimize its impacts.
So now I will ask both of you, what is your water body? What is the one that you both are not just passionate water users, you've made it your career, your life? Where did it all start?
I would say, you know, like a duckling, I imprinted on a water body when I was a kid. It was a nameless stream in Pennsylvania by a cabin where we would go for vacation. And it was, you know, just out the door, and you could go down and turn over rocks and look for crayfish and salamanders and water striders and all that stuff. And it's just an outlet for, you know, exploration. It was wonderful. And so as I've moved through my career, there are definitely places that I really love deeply. You know, the outer coast of Washington, British Columbia is just, you know, an amazing place. I got to live in New Zealand for a year, an amazing place. False Creek, an amazing place. But I still think of, you know, the thing that really got me hooked, probably the reason I'm a scientist at all, is because I could go down to this little stream and look for crayfish.
For me, I guess what really got me hooked was a field trip I had when I was growing up, where we went to the beaches of Delaware, where I grew up in the States, and did some beach seining. And so I just remember bringing in like this big haul of fish and other creatures the first time and just being fascinated that that was all there, because you don't really see that when you're just kind of swimming. And I just found that really eye-opening. And then seeing all the horseshoe crabs on the beaches there, just like lots of just amazing life. So much so that I made my parents then have, for my birthday party that year, we then had to go do a seining birthday party again. I think my friends probably thought I was crazy. They're like, oh, this is interesting. But then I guess similarly, when I was in undergrad in the Seattle area, going out on Puget Sound there and then kind of looking at the microscopic life in the ocean through like plankton nets and stuff like that, was what really got me hooked on like that aspect of ocean biodiversity. So
to take my like sports background, it's like, you know, the Delaware and Baltimore were like the minor leagues, and then the West Coast is kind of the big leagues, and now it's here. So it's, but I think those are really nice stories. I think they highlight the importance of connection. And that's the goal here at False Creek. The more connection we build to it, the more people are going to go on to do great things for our water. So
here, here.
So Colleen, can you tell us what the BioBlitz of 2022, what was the overall strategy and goals of this?
Yeah, so that was basically, BioBlitz was an event that came from a partnership between like the Hackeye Institute, False Creek Friends Society, the City of Vancouver also participated, and other organizations participated as a kind of overall effort to inventory and understand the biodiversity, so all the life in False Creek. And so it was a kind of a 4-day blitz, but also a like multiple month kind of long-term survey through using platforms like community science platforms like iNaturalist and stuff like that, to allow not only the scientists to be doing the inventorying, but also the community to really be involved.
Yeah, a BioBlitz is sort of like a real life version of Pokemon Go. And it's like, all right, everybody, we're going to go and look for things. And, you know, you get to add to your list. If people use iNaturalist, that's a great way to not only see what other people have found, but also, oh, yeah, this nudibranch I saw, this is amazing. I'm going to upload a photograph. And then you sort of get more engaged with you know, the wildlife and what other people are seeing, and encourage people to participate in it. Mm-hmm.
What was the overall summary of the results from the BioBlitz?
Well, we're definitely still working on synthesizing all of that into a nice report, hopefully. And I came into working on the BioBlitz specifically a little bit late. My colleague Matt Whalen really was a person that kind of really got it going working with False Creek Friends. And so, but he's moved on to Virginia and being a professor there. So I get to help kind of carry on with it. And I'm like very excited to do so. A goal of it was really to inventory the biodiversity of Falls Creek to kind of challenge this misconception that Falls Creek is not alive. And so I think we did that by going around, by engaging the community through having the iNaturalist page open or the project open for people to submit their photos to of what they observed. Over 500 different species observations were observed there. We did work from surveying the sediments and looking at life in the sediments and seeing how it's not super diverse at the, ahead of Falls Creek at the end there. But then diversity really increases as you work our way out to the more kind of flushed and open waters of Falls Creek. We also used environmental DNA to look at the kind of floating genetic material in the water of Falls Creek and, you know, detected 21 species of fish through our survey that we just did over 2 days, right? So that's just 2 days. Fish, as we know, move. Who knows? There could be lots more that we could detect if we keep surveying over time. But we also looked at microbes, lots of different types of microbes here. Most of them are the normal seawater microbes that are around, so not the, like, you know, microbes that we need to be worried about making us sick. So to me, as a microbe person, microbe lover, I like to think of that as, you know, it's pretty encouraging. I think the water, you know, necessarily isn't as gross as you would think. Maybe at times it could be. But at least when we were out there, I felt like it was, the major microbes out there were the good microbes. And lots of different invertebrates. Like, people saw us, came in, wanted to talk to us about what we were doing. We let people look through microscopes of what we were looking at. And I think that is doing science with the community is a great way to help people see what's there. Like, we had an outreach event at Science World recently where I just basically grabbed some seaweed off a dock and we were looking at it under a microscope, and people were like shocked that these like nudibranchs that we saw were just from Falls Creek. They're like, I didn't realize there was anything alive in there. And so just, I think, giving people the opportunity to kind of engage with life in Falls Creek in that way is very, well, I like to think, helpful and useful.
What is biodiversity for people? We hear it so much, but how do you just explain it in layman's terms?
Oh, geez. I was about to put on my professor of, introductory ecology hat on.
Sorry, no, then let me take that back. Yes, yes. Class is all in right. Session.
Well, biodiversity is, there are several levels at which you can consider biodiversity. The one that is probably most obvious to people is how many different species might you see in an area. But you can also consider genetic diversity. You know, like, are salmon stocks healthy because there's a lot of genetic diversity, or have they been winnowed down to a very, very inbred population? And you can also consider diversity among habitats. So, we could improve part of the seawall by building structures that encourage, mussels or things to grow on there. But if the entire shoreline was just mussels, that's not as diverse as if some of it was mussel bed and some of it was salt marsh and some of it was eelgrass. So there's also diversity at that scale.
Explain the difference between alpha and beta biodiversity.
So if you were going to go out to the shore with a little square quadrat, which is what scientists use, just imagine something that's 25 centimeters on a side, a little square, you set it down, you count all the species that are in there. And, maybe there's a dozen species. That's alpha. It's the very local scale. And you could set that quadrat down in a bunch of different places and say, yeah, in some places it's 10, in some places it's 15, but it averages out to about 12. What that ignores is that each quadrat might have a very different group of species in it from the next one. So as you go around the corner, you start finding things that you didn't see in the little embayment. And it's like, oh, there weren't urchins over there, but there are totally sea urchins over here. Oh, I didn't see these species of crab over there, but they're totally over here. So beta diversity is describing how different one spot is from the next. And that gets back to this sort of this habitat diversity idea of, if all of Falls Creek was just one cement wall, the alpha diversity might actually be pretty high because there's lots of things that can live on that, but the beta diversity would be very low because each little, each meter of shoreline is very similar to every other meter of shoreline. Whereas if some of it is, more of a salt marsh, or if some of it is boulders, or if some of it is sandy beach, then you increase beta diversity. And it's like, oh, this is the area with the clams. You wouldn't have found that on the concrete wall. And oh, this is the area with the starfish. You do find that on the concrete wall.
I don't have anything to add. That's perfect.
Then I'll shift, Colleen, for you, is how much has False Creek changed pre and post colonization?
Well, like, I'm definitely not fully an expert on the pre-colonization side of things, but in the reading that I've done and stuff like that, it's definitely changed a lot. It didn't used to kind of be the dead end that it is today. There was more connections with like Burrard Inlet and maybe even like with the Fraser River. And it was not obviously, I suppose, built up with skyscrapers. And so it was a lot more marshy and a lot of people accessing it for fisheries and livelihood and everything. So, and then I guess as it got developed, that all changed as we modified the landscape, broke, like kind of severed some of the connections with other bodies of water, which then reduces kind of circulation through here and definitely makes it harder to be like a well-flushed, productive and clean habitat in that way.
Your answer has made me realize it's in some ways analogous to a lung. And when the tide comes in, it's like the creek takes a big breath in and all the seawater comes in. And it used to be there were all these little, you know, nooks and crannies and creeks that the water would flow up into. And now those are, you know, often walled off to, you know, prevent erosion or support a building. And so the lung functions in a different way. It doesn't have the same capacity, the same volume of water is not coming in and out with every breath. So there have been a lot of changes just in the way the water flows.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
That is a really good analogy. I guess then the next question I have is like, how do we modify and adapt to that in this world where we can actually go back to blending the effectiveness of pre-colonization to now in a world where, you know, it's baked in, but we can start to address some of that.
I think we can consider that question in a lot of different ways. There's the physical space, which we've been focusing on. There's the which species are here. And if we're trying to get back to, you know, say the year 1800, we're just not going to be able to because the climate is different now. Some of the things that thrived then are not thriving now. Some things that used to only live in Japan are here now and completely happy to be here. And then I think there's also these sort of the attitudes, like the way people interacted with False Creek in 1700 when it was indigenous populations is different than the way an urban Vancouverite might now with, just a very different mindset. And I don't want to, you know, prioritize one of those mindsets over another, but I think they can learn from one another quite a lot.
One of the points you made there is that the, you know, species that came from Japan that are here now. What are those?
maybe the poster child is the Pacific oyster. So if you've been down to the shore, surely there's something at low tide in the background. That species came from East Asia as part of the efforts to build up aquaculture along this coast. And it is a very successful aquaculture species. If you go to Granville Island and order oysters, that is what you are getting. It is a warm water species, and British Columbia is a cold water coast. So for a long time, there were only like two or three inlets where the Pacific oyster could actually spawn because the rest of the shore was too cold. Not true anymore. So just in the past 5 or 10 years, there's been this population explosion, and Pacific oysters are now all over the place. And, you know, part of me is like, you know, oh no, invasive species, things are changing, bad, bad, bad. But that is still providing a lot of habitat for other little animals. It is providing some of the filtration capacity that we might have lost with native mussels. So it's not all bad news that that's happening.
I support that. I will take invasive Pacific oysters with my invasive Provence rosé because I think those will go excellent together. What are some of the physical factors?
Well, I guess I was thinking about just the not just the human side of things, but also there's just a lot of physical characteristics of False Creek that influences diversity, like, well, how deep it is, how fresh it can be at times, or how stratified it is, meaning you might have like warm water on top of cold water and it changes really quickly, or salty water like underneath fresh water, and that can really impact the type of life that can be here. So that's not just like because of us and the way we've modified the landscape, but that's also just because of how this body of water is connected to the ocean and everything, or the wider ocean and the Salish Sea and everything. And so that those sorts of impacts really impact diversity as well and can like greatly influence what we see here and when.
Yeah. Another thing to pay attention to are what we call foundation species. So in sort of an architectural metaphor, it provides the base for the rest of the ecosystem to be supported by. So eelgrass is a great example of that because so many different things use eelgrass as habitat, juvenile salmon, lots of, you know, Dungeness crab, and you know, all kinds of things. Oyster beds are a foundation, you know, mussel beds are a foundation. And if we see the False Creek changing in ways where it's really, you know, the water's really cloudy and turbid all the time and the light doesn't get to the bottom, well, then you can't have eelgrass as one of your foundation species. But if we had more oysters or mussels, maybe they would help to filter the water, or maybe there's some land use changes which would help, you know, prevent sediment and silt from coming in. And now all of a sudden the water is clean enough where you might start to see a few of these other things, you know, some of the seaweeds or some of the seagrass starting to come back.
So you're doing your part in being able to gather this information, communicate it. Is it being effectively implemented in policy when we're learning about this stuff?
I don't know. I mean, I personally haven't had a chance to talk with a lot of policymakers. That's, I guess, not the end of the science world that I work on, but I would love to more for sure and have conversations. I find that science, we as scientists can be sometimes more effective if we understand what the policymakers need to know to help them kind of restore an ecosystem or protect an ecosystem. And like, maybe I am just not presenting the results in the right way for them to understand. And so it's like, I think the more we can have those conversations, I hope that there will be more taken up. But I do see that Vancouver as a whole is definitely like the documents that I've seen about, you know, the restoration and Falls Creek and stuff like that. It does seem like there is a lot of work being done to try and make this a cleaner ecosystem. And I think that's pretty awesome that a city is kind of looking not just to like development of the city, but also kind of development of the nature that makes, I think, Vancouver one of the things that it is. So,
yeah. One of the things I really appreciate about living in Vancouver is how much people care about nature. Like even just the news stories that you see or hear are often focused more about nature things. And it's not just, oh, there was a fire, you know, a warehouse fire somewhere, or, you know, political stories. And, you know, those things are important too. But the fact that people care here is a wonderful way to make sure that politicians are also paying attention. Because if all Colleen and I did was, you know, some solid science and publish it in a paper, maybe present it at a scientific conference, that's not going to make much of a difference. We can try to go directly to policymakers, and there is some, you know, communication directly that way. But the other way to do it is to get the public engaged and say, hey, if you like oysters, ocean acidification is going to be an issue because it's threatening that aquaculture industry. And then if enough people care about that, they will tell the politicians, hey, we're worried about this. You need to do something about it. And that, I think, is a stronger bit of leverage if the general public demands something than if scientists say, hey, this needs to happen.
Which makes False Creek kind of like the perfect spot for that, right? Because you have it's like the funnel to bring people to the water, and it also allows them to become the conduits to be, you know, unintended advocates to create that policy change. And is this give False Creek this like very unique ability to be a catalyst for that?
Oh, yeah. And I see all kinds of positive feedback where, you know, if we clean it up a little and it becomes a little bit more accessible and more people come down and more people enjoy it and more people say, yeah, you know, I want, you know, let's bring some kids or, a classroom down here. Then that sort of snowballs a little bit. And then you have a larger group that cares more, and then more people are willing to put in effort for shoreline cleanups and other things, and then it gets even better, and away we go.
Yeah, there's a ton of schools within walking distance of Falls Creek, so the more we can, I think, engage those schools into kind of being kind of keepers of Falls Creek, probably the better. Then it gets kids walking outside and just kind of, yeah, really engaging.
Yeah, and a place for recreation. Like the swimmable Falls Creek idea is a really noble idea. If people really felt like they could safely do that, that'd be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it really is. That was what my intro to all this was swimming. It was, you know, I grew up in a place where you always went swimming. The idea of not being able to swim was foreign. And now in urban watersheds, that's something that's it's a barrier to people. And what is about False Creek being alive that can captivate people the most?
I guess for me, I think, and people probably in general connect more with life than with just water, you know, like, so if you see like a little seal struggling to survive out there, your like inclination is to try and save it, right? So I think the more we can connect with the life in False Creek, the more people might be compelled to like help there be more life and to kind of conserve the life that is there. So I think, you know, and for me, like personally, when I was little, some of the first things that got me engaged in the ocean was, you know, beach seining on a field trip or looking through a microscope when I was in undergrad out in Puget Sound. Like those things are what kind of locked in like ocean science for me. It was just like seeing just the like sheer diversity of life out there and the fact that like there's just so much unknown and so much we can like do on the daily to just kind of see what's there.
Yeah, I think there has been a tendency towards, you know, sort of manufacturing outrage and we've got to fight against this. And there really are things that you can be outraged about legitimately and you should fight against those things. But you can also find joy, like just finding, two crabs that are sort of in an embrace. That means they're getting ready to mate and there's going to be more crabs as a result of them having this cute little hug. And just being able to see that puts a smile on my face. Like, I don't study that. I don't gain any financial benefit from that happening, but it makes me happy. And getting people engaged in a biodiverse False Creek to bring them joy is a sufficient goal for me.
I love that because we need a lot more joy in this world. And we know that ecosystems not just provide that, but we are a part of that ecosystem that does that. I guess then that would shift me towards this idea that we had briefly talked about, is this idea of how we start to provide advocacy along the side of science. How is the shift from scientist to advocate happening? Does it need to happen more? Is it happening? I don't think it is a yes or no answer, but I'm curious on your thoughts of where we are in this current, not just political climate, but I think just in general, like information consumption, we're overloaded with knowledge where we have so many different options to do things. How do we keep people engaged on something like this that keeps science at the forefront of being a pillar in decision making?
Yeah, I'd say at its purest, science is intended to be neutral. Where we design a study or make a series of observations, and it allows us to make some predictions there. If we do, you know, one thing, we will end up with this scenario. And if we do a different thing, we'll end up with a different scenario. And then the scientist steps back and lets the public or the government decide, well, do you want to end up in scenario A or scenario B? But there, you know, scientists are also people and we care about things and have opinions. And so I think as long as scientists can be very clear where their data sort of ends and where their opinions and recommendations begin, then I think that can be healthy. But I think it has to be done with great care so that people don't start to distrust the science because they feel like the scientists have an agenda.
Yeah, I agree. I became a person that studies the ocean because I love the ocean. And so I advocate for the health of the ocean. I guess I feel like most people probably would do that regardless of, you know, their political leanings. Because I think we all love sitting on the water and just listening to the waves lap along the shore. Doing good science, reporting the results, and you know, but then also getting to be the person, the ocean lover that I am is, you know, I do care about it and I do advocate for its health, but I hope, well, I know that that doesn't affect my science because the results of observations or experiments are what they are. And I, you know, report those. And so I'm not going to change my results, even if it's not, you know, what I would hope it to be. In conversations that I've had with people about some of the work that we do, I'm like, well, what if the results that we are able to give you are different than what, you know, you hope? Because and we're not going to change those. And I'm not, you know, so it's, and, you know, it's always good to be open to whatever the findings are. And, you know, and sometimes they're even different than what we would expect. Like me, sometimes we think there'll be a great effect of ocean acidification on something. And then you're like, oh, actually, it was okay. Well, that's good. You know, like in the end, yay. We just have to do the best science that we can do. And then, you know, hopefully advocate for the environments that we love.
Yeah, I've got a graduate student right now named Georgia Hall who did this enormous experiment last summer in collaboration with the Hackeye Institute. And the questions were, you know, what is ocean acidification going to do to shellfish in BC? And how is it a potential threat to, you know, food security and everything else? And one of the hypotheses was that ocean acidification makes shellfish more vulnerable to other threats like a heat wave. And so we did all this work, exposed oysters and mussels to, you know, different acidities, and then brought them down to UBC and exposed them to a heat wave. And it turned out that the, you know, there was no effect on their thermal tolerance, whether they'd been acidified or not. And Georgia's instinct there was like, oh, that's so disappointing. We didn't get this exciting result. I'm like, well, that, you know, it is maybe less exciting in that sense, but it's great news that there's this one potential catastrophe that we appear to not be headed for.
That's funny, because one of the questions here is which species are likely to be winners and losers of climate change in False Creek? And now I'm going, I don't think, but like, what are the species that are impacted in just different ways without being winners or losers?
Yeah, I actually do think it's fair to ask about winners and losers, because there will be some. It is a bad time to be a mussel. The more acidic water is not great for them. This is a cold water species. Are sort of bay mussels or blue mussels, two different words for the same thing. And as we get less fresh water out of the Fraser because there's less snow to melt in the summer, that's not bad for the mussels themselves, but it's great for the starfish that eat mussels. So indirectly, that creates a problem for them. So we are losing mussel beds through time, and I don't see the climate changing back in a way that is going to favor them. But oysters, which we've also talked about, are going to be one of the winners because they evolved in warmer parts of the world. They're here now. They are going to do well in warmer water. They seem really pretty robust in the face of ocean acidification. They can handle a wide range of salinities. So we're already starting to see that shift from mussely shores to oystery shores. And, you know, we might mourn the loss of what we're used to, but we're retaining some of the benefits that the mussels provided because we have oysters now as a functional substitute.
Yeah, I guess I don't have a ton to add on that front, but I was thinking about just winners and losers in the context of like the habitat that is here. And the more we would allow there to be more like seagrass habitat or something like that, that's going to affect who can be here and like the larval fish that'll be around and stuff like that. So I think that'll, like, we might, through restoration and stuff like that, be able to promote some more wins, I suppose, if we provide more habitat for critters to be here.
And there's always going to be surprises. As much as we're able to learn, like, nobody saw sea star wasting disease coming. That's, you know, a pathogen that's impacted 20 different species of starfish. And the really big, glorious sunflower stars, those ones with 24 arms as big as garbage can lids, those are now an endangered species because that pathogen was so severe. That is more of a problem in warmer water. But, you know, that type of big outbreak, or, you know, the next species introduction, or, you know, who knows what weird thing is, like, oh, we're learning a lot about the contaminants from automobile tires and what that does. There's still a lot of surprises coming, and we just need to be ready to sort of adjust as we learn more.
Which then makes me think of the idea of False Creek as a living lab to continue to enhance that science, that engagement, that community activism, that involvement with an ecosystem and a water body that enhances all of our lives. And what would it look like to make False Creek a living lab for not just Vancouverites, but for the millions of visitors that come to this beautiful city as well?
I mean, I think that would be a really great thing. It'd be super unique if people came and visited and got to see not only like travel along on the Aquabus, but then also got to know more about the habitat here and what's in the life here. And I feel like science and and development and all that sort of stuff doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. And so I like this idea of like engaging the community, engaging the public through science and through discovery and through observation. I think it could actually, it would be a great thing. I think it would just help people be more connected with this, you know, body of water that we live on.
Yeah, and tremendous opportunity too. I mean, there are, in the busier times of the summer, and I think this is still true on the BC ferries, there's a naturalist on board who will talk to people about, you know, and if they're lucky enough to see a whale, of course, they've got a lot to talk about. But even just, you know, the natural history of the Salish Sea. And we could absolutely have, you know, guided walks along the seawall or boat trips up and down False Creek, arrange some of the floating docks. You know, those walk right past some pilings with a surprising amount of life on them. We can just, you know, put little signage down. It's like, yeah, when you come down here, here's some things to look for. And here's some of the neat little ecological stories that go with that. And, you know, people learn things that helps to stoke their curiosity. And, you know, the more curious people are, the better.
There's a lot of really cool instruments that you can put on ferries or on little boats that are constantly measuring things. So you can imagine just making a little fleet of, you know, measuring temperature, pH, salinity as all these boats go around, and just the constant stream of data that would help us understand False Creek. Maybe that would help us have a better understanding of how we could improve the health by just knowing more about it, right? See, like looking at their temperature or their salinity as they're cruising along, you might be like, huh, it changed right here. I wonder why.
And then it ties into, as False Creek Friends Society, our goal is to get False Creek designated as a national urban marine park. To get that, you need information, you need data. There's nothing more holistic and encouraging and, you know, empowering than to have everyone part of that. And what you just explained is exactly how we can get there in such a fun way. Yeah. And hopeful, I think, which is really nice. The two of you, it left me very hopeful for what we're doing with False Creek. And I think that's really encouraging in these times. Is there any parting words you'd like to leave on what you see for the future of False Creek?
I like to think of leverage points of where a small bit of effort has the largest reward. And in terms of engaging the public, like where are you going to find more of the public than in an urbanized water body like this? So the fact that so many people already live here or are already visiting to go to Granville Island, this is an opportunity to engage everyone in a really unique ecosystem, and then they can, you know, continue to enhance the place they live or take that home with them, that little bit of joy and understanding. And I think that'd be a huge win.
I think it would be easier for me to drag my kids on walks around the seawall if there was cool little things for them to do along the way. Then they wouldn't be groaning every time, like, let's go for this long walk or bike ride. So I think, yeah, I really think you could bring together, continue to rally the community around this environment. I think most people appreciate it. Probably everybody appreciates it and they don't even realize it. So I'm hopeful and I'm appreciative of the work that you all are doing, I would say, to kind of, you know, bring the community and False Creek to the community and the community to False Creek. So.
Well, now it becomes a big love-in because we are so appreciative of the work that you do, because we can't do any of it without the really, really important work that you do. And I think the fact that it comes from such passion, it's very motivating and just, yeah, pretty wicked. So, Colleen, Chris, thank you so much for being part of Water Bodies.
Yeah,
real pleasure.
Water Bodies is a production of the False Creek Friends Society. Please help spread the word and get involved. False Creek could use your help. Subscribe to our newsletter at falsecreekfriends.org for the latest news and volunteer opportunities. And what do you want to see in False Creek? You can leave us a comment. Water Bodies is a video podcast on YouTube and Spotify, and an audio podcast everywhere else. We'll see you next time.